on the other side here, you've seen a whole bunch of memorabilia, a whole bunch of stuff from N.A. And this guy over here, the next person I introduce, Danny, will be talking about some of that stuff. Danny?
The covering act named Danny.
Danny.
Hi, everybody. This is sort of like a dream come true. I first came to Narcotics Anonymous September 10th, 1983, and I relapsed for like 2.5 years, and I got clean in the penitentiary in Rockview State Penitentiary here in Pennsylvania. And when I got, I was always, anything ever related to my name was bad. And when I got out, I tried to beat the case. Back in the 80s, you always try to go to rehab and beat the case. Well, they threw me out the day before I went in front of the judge, and I got a 1.5 to 5. And I met a woman in the rehab who, when I got out, I wound up marrying and having 2 kids with. And she was involved in service. She was involved in the Greater Philadelphia Regional Convention number 5. And she took me down there. And I just went down to support her. And the convention chair was messing up and not making the meetings regularly. And they nominated me and voted me in as convention chair. And when the minutes came out, it said Danny M., Philadelphia Convention Information Chair. And I saved that first piece of paper. Well, being an addict, is that first piece of paper led to that room over there and a whole lot more. There's actually only like 5 bins of stuff out over there. And I brought 4 others, but won't even fit in that room. And I have like 27 of them. And I didn't even know I was collecting. I just saved that piece of paper. And I happened to be at that 4th Marlichna that Mike got a tape of. I was there in the front row. And Greg P. was the speaker on NA history. I don't know why I went to history, because I didn't do good in school with history. But I went to Narcotics Anonymous history and sat in that front row, and he talked about it, and he brought these goodies. And they were like the white books from the 50s and the 60s. And I actually shared on that tape. So if you buy the CD or you have the cassette tape, I'm on there at the end sharing. I don't even know what I said. All I know is I was in awe, and I was taken out by the history of it. And I went up to him and I said, I want some of them goodies. How do I get them? And he said, you can't get these goodies. They're from the 50s and 60s. Well, the manipulating, conning, diseased addict I am, I probably have a couple of each of the books now. And it became a mission for me about the history of Narcotics Anonymous. And I've been collecting for 24 years now. And I learned a lot. And it gave me an identity, because my identity was shit until I got to Narcotics Anonymous. And I always wanted to collect something, you know what I mean? I had a little comic book collection and maybe like a football card collection, and I don't even know whatever happened to them, so obviously they weren't that important to me. But when I started collecting this NA history thing, it became an obsession. And I had a business where I made okay money, and in the winter, it got slow. And for 4 months out of every year, I put a lot of time and effort into collecting NA history stuff. And this was before the internet. Thank God for the internet, because it made it easier for the new collectors. You go to eBay or Google stuff. You know, there was no Google. And what I did was I wrote a standard letter, and I sent it. I wrote a book letter, a magazine letter, and one other letter. And it was a standard one, and I just copied it. And I put, and there was magazine collectors, newspaper collectors and book collectors. And I would send them out in mass mailings, asking for specific books. Greg P. did a chronology of Narcotics Anonymous, and in that, he listed books and magazines and newspapers. So I had an idea what I was looking for, and I did mass mailings, and people would write me back and say they had this book, and, you know, The Addict, and the Time magazine, and, you know, and being The Addict, and they were like $2. I got stuff for 50 cents. And, you know, because they were laying around for 50 years. Nobody collected that stuff. And I don't know if I was the first collector ever, but I sure felt like it. A lot of people lived it and kept the stuff, but nobody was running around the country collecting it like I was. So I went to Dutch. Dutch is a recovering addict. He got clean December 30th, I think, 1971. In Philadelphia, moved to Atlantic City, New Jersey. And I went to his house, and we made a list of all the old-timers on the West Coast and the East Coast. And then I was on the phone, and I was calling addicts, and I was going to their houses, and I was going through their garages, their attics, under their beds, I went to their mom's houses, and their attics, and their garages. And really, my collection is our collection. And that's why I bring it and share it, and anybody can copy it, take pictures of it, whatever you just want, because, not that I'm smart, but all I did was compile it together and put it together. But it's everybody's. Everybody gave it to me. Without people giving me it, I wouldn't have nothing. I mean, I spent a lot of money collecting stuff and going to world conventions and spending $1,500 on merchandise at a world convention, or, you know, this year I only spent $900, so my budget was a little, you know, slimmer. And what I learned is that, now let me just say this first. Daniel Carlson, for some reason, I guess I was attracted to him because his name was Danny and so was mine. But Jimmy Kinnon, I loved him for what he did to Narcotics Anonymous, because I feel as though he's the backbone of Narcotics Anonymous and we're here today because of him. But I believe that Daniel Carlson started Narcotics Anonymous. And Jimmy's the one that put the icing on the cake, so to speak, because he implemented the traditions, and that's why we still have Narcotics Anonymous. And Jimmy is a painter and a roofer, which is what I've been my whole life. And I'm still a roofer. Don't ask me how I do, because I'm getting old. So I have love for both of these men. And what I want to try to, like, introduce you to these people and give you an idea. When this guy, Houston Sewell, he was an engineer, a streets engineer, and he got transferred to Kentucky. And he had a home group, an AA home group there, and he started doing an H&I meeting and taking it into Lexington. And he was doing the AA H&I, and he met this guy, Harry, who he formed a bond with. And Harry could get sober in AA, but he kept relapsing on drugs. And this guy, Houston, didn't understand that, and he wanted to help him. So he came up with the idea that if the 12 steps for Alcoholics Anonymous could help an alcoholic, maybe if we started a thing for addicts with 12 steps, maybe it could help a drug addict. And that guy, Daniel Carlson, was in and out 8 different times of this Lexington that started in 1935. And Mike touched on it. They did electric shock treatments to addicts, too, that he didn't mention. And Roy P., I'm going to get into that, he got some electric shock treatments in Santa Monica. And so he went to Victor Vogel, who was the doctor around the place, and asked if he could start a 12-step fellowship for addicts. And they named it Addicts Anonymous. You know, addicts and addicts anonymous, alcoholics anonymous. And when Daniel Carlson left and started Narcotics Anonymous, there was two reasons why he started Narcotics Anonymous in New York. One was because all the drugs back then were called narcotics, and the other one was Addicts Anonymous, AA, infringed on Alcoholics Anonymous, AA's name. So that's why he called it Narcotics Anonymous. So he started this and went to New York, and he found that there was people taking addict information into that woman's house of detention in Greenwich Village in New York. And he wanted to go there, and he hooked up with Brigadier Dorothy Berry, they call her Dolly, who worked for the Salvation Army, and he got close with her. And she gave him an office and a phone and all, and he didn't have any money. And every time, Dan was a pauper, he put his whole entire life into Narcotics Anonymous, just like Jimmy Kinnon did. these guys' dime broke because they gave their blood, sweat, and tear to Narcotics Anonymous to make it what it is. And Danny, he was trying to raise funds. And they didn't have no seventh tradition because there wasn't no seventh tradition. And he used the YMCA, and he would get meetings wherever he could, and it was tough. We're talking like 1949, 1950. You know, if you were a drug addict, you were the scum of the earth. You know what I mean? We were the scum of the earth into the 70s, you know, into the 80s maybe even, until we started recovering and we became productive members of society. Well, back then, man, you were like, you know, stay away from me if you're a drug addict, because they all have bad names, just, you know, like using addicts do today. So he got these civic-minded people together, which were lawyers and doctors and stuff, and they formed this thing called NACON, which was a National Advisory Council on Narcotics. And what they set out to do was raise funds, raise money for Narcotics Anonymous to pay for the phone bill, to rent an office, and they had a couple different offices in New York. I went up and I interviewed Father Dan Egan, the junkie priest. I videotaped him. I took pictures. I had him sign some books, the junkie priest books. I went to the different offices and took pictures. I went to Daniel Carlson's house and took pictures. I interviewed Daniel Carlson's psychologist, who was on the board of directors for that NACON. His name's Arnold Bernstein. He's actually still alive. I went in and interviewed him, and he told me that they never even raised any funds for Daniel Carlson, that NACON. And Father Dan Egan told me he never met Daniel Carlson. Daniel Carlson died on August 19th of 1956. So Bill Wilson has a tombstone on his grave for AA, and it says founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I always had in my mind that if I found Daniel Carlson's grave, it would say founder of Narcotics Anonymous. And in the obituary, it says that he died of cancer in Montefiore Hospital, which is in the Bronx. So I was on the phone. I was a research monkey like Mike, too. It was all about, you know, the fix, getting more Narcotics Anonymous archives. And I called. Well, there's so many freaks. I think everybody dies in New York and gets buried in New York. I found like 100 cemeteries in New York. I probably called 20 or 30 of them. I finally surrendered, and I can't find them. So for years, I wrote to the Vital Records in New York to get Daniel Carlson where he was buried at. So finally, there was these couple guys from North Carolina named Boyd and Chris. They did a PowerPoint for Narcotics Anonymous basic text. Boyd had the spiritual awakening at Texas, the Texas World Convention, and he wanted to know where Narcotics Anonymous came from, and he started doing NA history research, and he found out that Bo gave Kermit all his boxes of the stuff on the basic text. So he went there, and then he went to Bo's house, and then he went to Greg Pierce's wife, Lois's house, and he compiled all this stuff with the basic text, and they put this PowerPoint together. Well, they found this book called Slaying the Dragon, and it was written by a guy named Bill White. And Bill White was an alcoholic, recovering alcoholic in AA. And what Slaying the Dragon is the dragon is the disease of addiction, killing the disease of addiction. And he wrote this book from all the way back into the 1800s. Everything that had anything to do with anything between rehabs and Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, Addicts Anonymous, and all this stuff. Well, there was 30 pages written on Alcoholics Anonymous and only 3 written on Narcotics Anonymous. So he called them up. Chris and Boyd called him up and said, how come there's 30 pages of Alcoholics Anonymous and only 3 of Narcotics Anonymous? He said, well, that's all the research that I did, and that's all that I found. And they sent him the PowerPoint that they did. And he called them back and said, I think you're the guy who can help. If you can get facts about Narcotics Anonymous, I'll let you write 30 pages of Narcotics Anonymous, and I'll put it in my revised book. So he basically hired him, and when you get into that Narcotics Anonymous history, because I've been involved in it in 24 years, you find me. Well, they found me, and boy came to my house and stayed. He said, look, I want to look at your archives. I said, well, you better book a week. He said, are you kidding me? I said, no, I got like 27 tubs of Narcotics Anonymous stuff, and if you want to sit down and go through it, I'll be more than glad to. So he came to my house, and he stayed a week. Here, his girlfriend, his parents, and she's from Willow Grove, and got clean and today incorporated, which Dutch started the first Narcotics Anonymous meeting there. And so she came the day that he was leaving my house and stayed with the mom, and then he went to the mom's, and then they went, you know, toward the Philadelphia and did the whole trip around, and, you know, Alfred's Alley and the Liberty Bell and Betsy Ross house and all that crap. So it worked out perfect. So we got to stay there a week. But the funny thing is we went and looked at my archives for about a half an hour. And I came up with this idea that I was going to take them on a trip of a lifetime. And I'm going to tell you, for a week, I was high on Narcotics Anonymous. On archives. I mean, I was actually high. And after he left, I actually crashed. I'm dead serious. It was like shooting archives. It was great. So the first thing I do is I take him to this guy's house called Johnny Books, who lives in New York. He's got the best book collection in the world. So we go there, and we look through his... And I call him up first, and I said, look, I got this guy from North Carolina. Can we come there and look at your archives? You got to bring them all out. I said, he's involved in writing a book, 30 pages, and I think you could help. He said, sure, come on up. So we go there. We look for about 12 hours. We crash. We get up the next day and look for 12 hours. He brings a scanner. Johnny let us scan everything, and we're scanning and scanning. Now, Johnny's got the very first basic text that ever came off the printer. And it don't have the NA logo on it or not, but it has all the pages on it and where. And it's the first edition, which was the red. Where the number thing is, it says pre-edition for weight purposes only. Jimmy wanted that book because he knew he was going to send it around the world, and he wanted to see what it was going to cost. So he had that book. Then he had, there's two first silver edition basic texts that were ever made in the world. One went to Jimmy Kennett, and one went to the printer, whose name was Jeannie. She still works at the World Service Office. Silver. I mean, these things are badass, man. I, like, almost came in my pants when I seen it. When I seen this one. I mean, that's how hot this thing was. So, Mike knows the feeling. Believe me. He jerked off over archives, too. And anybody else that has, tip my hat off to you. That's my thing. So then he had Jimmy Kennan's first red edition, number 2. He had his first blue edition. He had a gray book, and he didn't even know it, but Boyd knew it, that they numbered the first gray books, the first couple of them, and he knew that Kermit had number 3, and they never knew where 1 was. And Boyd says, you know what? That might be number 1. And Roger Teague, who passed away from HIV virus, who lived in New York, he was involved in sending them out. Joe Proctor's family printed the great books, 1,100 of them, and they sent them to every home group in the world at the time from Tennessee. And they put it in pencil. And Roger Teague had a letter there. Jimmy, this is the first one off the printer to you. Love, Raj T. So, and I got pictures of it. Anything I'm talking about, I got proof. So, anyway, I used to bullshit. I don't bullshit as much. Still not perfect. So, anyway, Boyd looked up there, and there, for sure enough, man, in pencil, it had the number 1. So Johnny's got number 1 gray book. Then we're looking through his stuff more, and the fifth edition, there was a millionth printing of the fifth edition, and they made 5,000 books. It's a gray fifth edition, and it has a silver and blue marker in it. Well, he's got the millionth book because he has number 1 of the millionth book, which is the millionth book. So this guy's got some serious, you know, serious collection of books and stuff. He happens to have some serious money, and I'm a little jealous and envious that this guy, you know, has all this stuff. How he found me was he was buying stuff off of eBay, and a guy who was at RSR out of Philadelphia named John S. got in touch with him, and he said, oh, you think I got some stuff? You got to see this guy Danny Martino in Philadelphia. So he called me up. He said, yeah, this is John. I wanted to see if I could check out your NA collection. I'm like, who? He's there. I'm from New York. I'm like, an addict from New York? You ain't coming to my house, bro. So I met him down the street, introduced him, you know. I had to meet him, and all. I was a little worried, you know. I didn't know if this guy had guns or what kind of recovery he had or anything. I knew he was coming to look at my archives, which I showed some people my archives, but nobody ever called out of the blue wanting to see my stuff. So we got tight anyway, and that's how I got to take Boyd up to his house. So after we go to Boyd's house, we go to George R., who's on his way here or might be here. He was involved in writing the basic text. He sold his washer and dryer, his washer and dryer, so that he could attend World Lit conferences and write the basic text. And he was like 18 years old at the time, 19 years old. And a lot of kids got involved in writing the basic text. And so we went and we interviewed him and talked to him. Then we went to this guy, Jim H., who was the fifth Narcotics Anonymous member on the East Coast. We interviewed him at his home group for 2 hours. Now this is all video and audio, pictures, all that stuff, everybody we interviewed. Then we got Roy P., who was he brought Narcotics Anonymous back to the East Coast with the 12 traditions. He met Jimmy at an AA convention in Santa Monica. I'll get into that story a little bit later. And he brought that light bulb. We interviewed Roy P. for 4 hours at my house. And Roy P. was supposed to be here speaking at this meeting right now, but he passed away June 1st with 17 years clean. And he was a great man. He was one of my very good friends. So we got to interview him. And then we went to this guy, Dave F.'s house that lives in Norristown. He got clean in 1974. We interviewed him, and he had some Daniel Carlson stuff. He's one of the Daniel Carlson believers that started Narcotics Anonymous. And he had some original stuff, and he had copies, and I tried to buy them and manipulate them, but he didn't get off of them. But I even, was willing to trade stuff, and, you know, but it didn't happen. Anyway, we interviewed him, and then we drive all the way down to Easton, Maryland, and we go to Mike's house. And I found out that Mike's a hoarder. When he collects in 50s and 100. Now, I'm serious. We went in his basement, and there was just I thought I had, a nice collection. I had, a variety of different stuff, but when he got a hold of one thing, he had, 20 or 30 of them. I couldn't believe it. So I had to take pictures of everything, and it was a great experience going to Mike's house. What I learned about him on that day was he's got the best Daniel Carlson collection in the world, and he's got by far the best audio. Anything to do with tapes and CDs and all, if anybody knows somebody that's on tape or CD that they like and you can't find it anywhere, get Mike's number. You just found it, because he's got serious, 5 feet tall, 10 feet long of just audio stuff. Serious business. So me and Boyd came back to my house, and he left, and I'm telling you, I crashed. After shooting Narcotics Anonymous archives for a week, it was a 3-day crash. So I got even depressed a little bit that the mission was over, and then I got to be on the edit squad when they wrote that 30-page stuff, and I got to edit it, and I went to, then I got an opportunity. I was going to Florida and driving, and I got an opportunity to stop in Raleigh, North Carolina at Boyd's house, because he had Bo's stuff, and Bo said that I could buy whatever I wanted. So I went there on another archives mission, and I picked out all the stuff that I wanted from Bo's collection, and I got a couple things through the mail that I sent Bo money for, but the stuff that I put to the side, I still never got. I don't understand why. I'm going to get it. I got all that other shit. So when I was there, I always was, you know, I'm always in the hunt for archives. And I always Googled Daniel Carlson, and Ancestry.com would come up every now and then. But I ain't paying for Ancestry.com, and I'm not giving them my credit card information. So I go, I'm over at Boyd's house, and his mother has to do something with grave sites and all, and she is a member of Ancestry.com. And he had to go to work. So I'm up early. He puts me on the computer and punches in his mom code, and I'm on Ancestry.com. So I'm looking through Ancestry.com, and boom, I find a 1920 census with Daniel Carlson as a kid. Here I find his mom, Jane E. Dunaway. Okay? Now, this is the reason why I'm getting to this is because I want to talk and get and introduce you to Daniel Carlson, who he is. Daniel Carlson was born in Hamada, Puerto Rico. He was a Puerto Rican. So two of the first main members of Narcotics Anonymous were Puerto Rican because it was Daniel Carlson and then it was Ray Lopez. And the funny thing is on the West Coast, the guy who's got the most time clean on the West Coast is a black guy named Bob B. So there's all kinds of ethnic groups in Narcotics Anonymous, which is great because that makes us diverse, which means we can go into other countries and bring in Narcotics Anonymous. We got 58,000 meetings going in 146 countries now, man. So, which I'm grateful for. So, I find these senses of Daniel Carlson and the mom. So, there's a woman in New York named Catherine C., and she's doing an NA history thing for New York, and they weren't going to do the Daniel Carlson thing, but they got in touch with me, and what I did was I got about 30 different books, several magazines, several newspaper articles. So what I did was I copied everything, the front of the books or the front of the magazines and the actual article in there, and I mailed them all this stuff up in New York, and that changed their mind that they're definitely writing about Daniel Carlson. And this other guy also in Florida told them that they should write about it too. A guy named Big J down in Florida. He's originally from New York. He lives in Miami now. He's actually speaking at an NA history thing right now in Florida. No, on Saturday night he's going to. Tomorrow night. And actually it was supposed to be my commitment. I had this commitment and that commitment at the same time, so I swapped with Big J. I said, Jay, you take that one because he lives in Florida, so he's doing that tomorrow night. But he encouraged them to write about the Daniel Carlson thing too. So I also became an editor for them. And we were talking to Catherine a little earlier. She just finished up another chapter. And she, now, the funny thing is I'm a ninth grade graduate, and I got my GED in prison, and I'm this friggin' editor for Narcotics Anonymous history stuff. It's pretty funny. So we find her. Now, I tell her about Jane Dunaway. She gets in touch with a sister or something who puts her in touch with Daniel Carlson's granddaughter, who lives in Nevada. Her name's Donna Carlson. So I get her phone number, and I call Donna in Nevada, and I'm like, Donna, I've been trying to find your grandfather's vital records in New York. I want to find where he's buried at and all. I said, if I mail you the money, will you get me, you know, send away for the vital records? I'll fill out all forms all in all. I'll send you the money order. All you got to do is sign it, write a letter that you're the granddaughter, and send it in. She does it. We get the vital records. I get a death certificate. And on the death certificate, it says he's buried in Flushing Cemetery in Flushing, New York. Oh, within a week, man, I'm up there trotting around in a foot of snow with Catherine and Jimbo. Jimbo's right over there. Right? We're in a foot of snow running around the cemetery for 2 friggin' hours. Right? So finally, I get the idea to call the front office. I'm like, where the hell's the gravestone at? He said, I'll be right out. So the guy comes out. There's no headstone for Daniel Carlson. Now, my dreams of finding his headstone saying founder of Narcotics Anonymous don't exist. So we put a committee together, and there was actually 12 people on the committee, and we all donated money, and we got Daniel Carlson a headstone, and it was put on a week before his 55th death birthday. So it got put on in August, 55 years later, and we got the Man of Heads done, and I think that's pretty friggin' cool. And it says, the founder of Narcotics Anonymous in New York in 1949. Daniel Lawrence Carlton, which we found out through Ancestry.com. So that Ancestry.com is worth something. So that's something cool that we did. I want to talk about a little bit about Jimmy Kinnon. I know Fawn, if she ever hears this tape, she's going to kill me. But I'm just, I love Fawn, and she is a dead, diehard Jimmy Kinnon fan. She worked at the World Service Office for years, and she was right there with him when he was struggling, and they were copying stuff, and they didn't have no money, and addicts were calling from all over the world, and they were sending stuff out, and I understand where she comes from and loves Jimmy. And I wanted to say that just in case she ever gets a hold of this tape, because she knows I live in Philadelphia. So, anyway, Jimmy Kinnon wasn't the founder of Narcotics Anonymous on the West Coast either, okay? An AA guy was. AA is big in our history. AA guy started Addicts Anonymous, which an addict came named Daniel Carlson, who went to New York and started Narcotics Anonymous. An AA guy named Jack Crow in Hollywood, California, started Narcotics Anonymous. And Jimmy was actually the second addict that came there. The first addict was a guy named Cy Malice, who Jimmy always butted heads with. And I found out a history on Jack. On this guy, Cy Malice. Cy Malice lived in Philadelphia at one time, and he was a baseball player, and he played for the Philadelphia Phillies. So he was a strong personality. You know how athletes are. They're very egotistical and stuff. So he always said that he founded Narcotics Anonymous. And if you look in the Jewish Baseball Hall of Fame book, it says right in there that he was the founder of Narcotics Anonymous. Okay? So Jimmy butted heads with him. This guy Jack started the first Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and Cy Malice was the first addict alcoholic. He was on narcotics through his whole recovery because he was in the Navy and got a bad injury, and they put him on narcotics. And because they weren't street narcotics, he felt as though he was recovering. And your recovery is based on what you think, I guess. Don't say something like that in the basic text. So anyway, Jimmy came, and he got clean February 2nd, 1950 in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that's his date because one of my old sponsors, Henry D., who lives in Arizona now, who's from Philly, his clean date is February 2nd. So, Jimmy, they knew that Jimmy was an addict because he used to say he was a drug addict and an alcoholic. Okay? And he was the third person who came in. And Jack said that he had forgot about Jimmy, that he was an addict. Well, what happened was, I'm going to give you an analogy of how it went down. It's like Mike starts a home, Jim starts, he's an alcoholic, and he comes and starts a home group. And Mike's the second one in. So, and then I'm the third one in, and Jim sees that two addicts are taking care of Narcotics Anonymous, so he rolls back to AA. Now, me and Mike are getting this home group together, and we're butting heads a little bit because he wants to set up the meeting, and I want to set up the meeting, and he's making the coffee, but I make it better, and he made it better that week, and he's putting out the literature, and we're butting heads. And then finally, Mike goes, and who would be Cy Malice, who died in 72. And Jimmy took Narcotics Anonymous under his wing and helped write literature, and was at the first meeting where they made minutes of. And he's the one who was the backbone of Narcotics Anonymous. And that first Brown book, there's a very first Brown book that was written. It was written by Cy Malice, Jack Crow, and Jimmy Kinnon. And in there, the thing that makes Jimmy Kinnon, to me, the best guy in Narcotics Anonymous is that they used the word we in front of the steps, and he used the word addiction. And when it became addiction, it became a medical problem. And when it became a medical problem, the hospitals and institutions were able to get involved in it because it was a disease now, and that's how detoxes and Daytop and all those Synanon and all those things started opening up and helping the addicts. And the other thing, the wonderful thing that Jimmy did in 1959, he implemented the traditions in the Narcotics Anonymous. And they're the wonderful things that Jimmy did to make it what it is. He had the World Service Office at his house for years when they got thrown out of a building and all. And people locked him out of the office, and he died soon after that because they broke his heart, man. Broke his friggin' heart because that was his baby. And I got to tell you, Jimmy gave up his family and all. And I'm going to tell you a little story about Jimmy that a lot of people don't know. Jimmy lived, he lived in Scotland, and when he came to Ellis Island, he moved to Philadelphia. And he lived in the Pacconi section of Philadelphia. Well, I got pictures of where he lived. I got pictures of Agnes's house where she lived. And I got the church that they got married in, pictures of that. He met her riding on a bicycle because he was a bartender, Jimmy was. And he met Agnes and he wound up marrying her. And they had a bunch of kids. And they moved to California. And Jimmy's brother married a woman named Betty Kinnon, okay? And Jimmy and Agnes had a daughter named Kathy Kinnon. Well, Betty and Jimmy's brother had a kid named Kathy Kinnon, too. And when Agnes died, Jimmy's brother and Betty broke up, and Jimmy married Betty. So there's two Kathy Kinnons, okay? Kathy Kinnon Linder, who was the one that wrote Every Addict's Friend, Jimmy Kay. That was her dad. The other one is a stepdaughter, which is really Jimmy's brother's daughter, okay? So I want to clear that. Yeah, it's a little twisty. If anybody didn't get that right, get with me after the meeting. Jimmy married his brother's wife, Betty Kinnon, and that was Jimmy's second wife. And I'll tell you why I remember that so good, because I have a little Jerry Springer story in my life, too. My dad divorced my mom on her deathbed when she had cancer, and he married a 16-year-old girl, and they had a kid. And then she had another kid. Well, we found out a little ways down the road that my brother was having sex with her, too. So I had a half-sister with her and a niece with the same girl. Well, she wound up dying of cancer, too, just like my mom. And before she died, of course, she was with my dad for 10 years, and my dad died of cancer. And after he died, she married my brother. So she went from my stepmother to my sister-in-law overnight. So I got a little craziness in my life, and that's why I know that Jimmy's got his. Plus, he was a roofer and painter, which is like me. So we're all fucked up here, including Jimmy. I don't really want to curse, but... And what makes us fucked up is we got the disease of addiction. And we're never right, you know what I mean? But we do what we can to be right. So I wanted to talk about that. What time we got?
8:19.
Oh, we got... Wow. You got too much time there, Mike. You're not nice. All right, so I'm going to talk a little bit about my friend Roy, who was supposed to be here tonight and sharing at this meeting. I met Roy, being the archivist wackadoo I am. There was these two brothers named Mike and Brian Higgins. Good people in the Philadelphia area. Brian was my sponsor for 6 years, and Billy A. was my grand sponsor, and Joe Proctor was my great-grand sponsor. And we just talked about this. My great-great-grand sponsor, there you go. So they told me they knew the guy who started Narcotics Anonymous on the East Coast. And I was like, yeah, okay. And they kept saying, I'm telling you, I know this guy Roy. He was a good friend of my dad's. His dad, Mike Higgins, Big Mike Higgins, was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they had a lot of years sober in AA. So they all came to work for me. The brothers and the dad were working for me. I had a painting business. Like I said, I was a painter and roofer my whole life, like Jimmy Kinnon. And I asked the father, I said, do they really know, you know, a guy who started, he said, oh yeah, this guy, Roy Porter. I said, I want to meet him, man. So they hooked me up with him, and I go to Roy's house, and I go up, you know, up by Tyler State Park in Bucks County, and I'm driving up this long driveway, and I go to this house, and I knock on the door, and he comes, and he owned an elevator business, and he had some money. You know, he was an addict, put a lot of time and effort into his elevator business, and I interviewed him, I audioed him and videoed him, just like I did everybody else. And by doing that, I helped him out. See, he was an addict who didn't want to be an addict. And he seeked out everything, Buddhist, Christianity, meditation, all these other things. And he finally surrendered that he was an addict in like 1976, and he died with 17 years clean, which was friggin' awesome. And I was like a little springboard for him to get back into Narcotics Anonymous, because he realized the importance that he had. And his story is, his mom was from Philadelphia, and his dad was from California, and his dad was a doctor, and the dad was an addict who used. And, you know, Roy would go back and forth from Philly to California. You know, when it got too bad in Philly, he would go to California. When he got too bad in California, he'd come back. Well, by the time he was 19 years old, he was a bad meth addict, acid, losing his mind on drugs. So he goes to an AA meeting in Glenside, Pennsylvania. And he's a drug addict, and he looks like a drug addict. So they basically tell him to leave. And when he leaves this Flower Town meeting, I'm sorry, I said Glenside, I meant Flower Town, Pennsylvania. A woman comes out, and she says, look, there's this meeting called Young Men's down in Philadelphia, and they help all kinds of people like you. They won't throw you out. Go there, here's the address, go look these people up. So he goes there. Now, this place was hardcore. They would handcuff you to a radiator in their meeting to detox, and leave you there and come and feed you. That's how serious these alcoholics were. And they dealt with addicts and all. And these guys, they said, look, you can't drink or use no matter what. If you want to do burglaries, you can, because you're going to be a better burglar if you don't use. And they condoned all that stuff. They didn't care what you did as long as you stayed sober and clean, man. So these guys were pretty cool. And this guy, Dick Flanagan, was a founding member of that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. So after 90 days, they had a wall of fame. If you got 90 days, you were allowed to put your name on the wall. Well, Roy put his name on it, and other dudes went up and put drug addict and everything. So he caught it, and he wound up wiping it off. And I got a picture of that wall. So he split to go back to California, and he was out there. He wound up using again. He went into his dad's closet, who was using, and he wound up stealing his dad's drugs and getting all messed up again. And he went into an insane asylum in Santa Monica. And he was in there, and they were giving him shock treatments and everything. And he met this guy who was sober in AA, but he had relapse. And he was talking all this great stuff about Alcoholics Anonymous. And Roy said, well, if it's so great, what are you doing here? You know, you use. And he's trying to tell him, you know, that he made a mistake and that, you know, he fell off the wagon and all that, all those AA sayings and all. So Roy's dad had a friend named Bobby Lang, who was a jazz pianist who was sober in AA. And he knew, like, all kinds of people in California, Lucille Ball, Red Skelton, and all these people. And he went and visited Roy in there. And he said, look, I'll, you know, if you work this way of life, I'll take you around with me, and the alcoholics won't throw you out of the meetings. And so he started going to AA meetings with him, and he said he felt out of place. He was 19 years old, he was a straight drug addict, and he's in these AA meetings with all these old guys. And, you know, he said this to me, like, what can I can't relate to these old guys falling off a stool at a bar. You know, I'm out shooting dope and shit and chasing drugs, and I can't relate to them. So he took them to an Alcoholics Anonymous convention. And at their convention, there were some addicts that had a back room, and Jimmy Kay was one of them. And Jimmy Kay being originally from Philadelphia, took a liking to Roy because he was from Philadelphia. And he gave him a white book. And he said, go back to Philadelphia and start Narcotics Anonymous. So Roy came back, and he goes to Young Men's. And he says, I want to start the Narcotics Anonymous meeting. How do I do it? And they had a... Oh, that's way later. So anyway, he goes to Young Men's and says, I want to start a meeting. Well, Dick Flanagan worked at Eagleville Hospital at the time. He was a therapist there. So there was a doctor who ran the place named Dr. Ottinger. And he went and introduced Roy to Dr. Ottinger. And Roy was all high on the hog about Narcotics Anonymous, man. He's all fired up. You know, he's trying to go to places and start meetings, and they're telling him that he can't because they don't deal with drug addicts. And they wanted references. Well, where's other meetings at? And we want to talk to the people where the other meeting, and there was no other meeting, so he didn't have no references. He tried to start this one over in Bryn Mawr, New Jersey, and a state trooper ran him out of town and said if he ever came there with drug addicts to his town, he was going to lock them all up and everything. So he goes and meets this Dr. Ottinger, and he's sitting there in front of a doctor who's running a rehab. Now, Eagleville Hospital was a tuberculosis hospital, and in 1966, I think, they switched over and started alcoholics, helping alcoholics. Well, in 68, they decided they were going to help drug addicts. So they were already familiar with drug addicts, but there was no meeting there. So Roy goes there in front of this doctor, Ottinger, and says, look, I want to start Narcotics Anonymous here, and once I start it, you can close this rehab down because all you need here is Narcotics Anonymous, and you don't need any of that therapy and counseling, and if your guys are going to be burglars, as long as they're clean and sober, they'll be better burglars and second-story men. The doctor's like, whoa, this guy's, no, let me think about this. I don't know. So Roy and Dick roll out, and like Dick gives him a lecture like, yo, dude, this is a doctor, you know, he's running a rehab. You're telling him to shut it down. You're going to try to take his job away. You guys, you know, making money for it. So he goes, look, I'm going to see if I can get you another interview with Dr. Ottinger. And he gets him another interview. And he tells, and Dick says, look, cool out, Roy. Calm down, man. Just see if you can get a meeting started. So he goes there, and it was the summer of 1969, and he started the first meeting on the East Coast in that hospital. Now, Roy relapsed after that. But the interesting thing was there was these two brothers that came, a guy named Danny and Mike Sheehan. Mike is still alive. He lives in Florida. Danny died like 2 years ago. And their father, Jim, was a big-time guy in AA. And they were running he was running a meeting at the All Saints Church in Broad and Duncannon. And the sons said that they wanted to start a meeting. Well, Roy and the two sons started a meeting in the All Saints Church, and they put them in the basement where there was no toilets or nothing. They had to go outside and pee outside under the bush. God bless the women, because Roy says to this day he don't remember what the women did when they had to go to the bathroom. So they put them in there, and they gave them a meeting space, and the alcoholics in AA got mad at Mike and Danny's dad, Jim, for letting them bring a meeting in there, and that was the first meeting in Philadelphia. And for the longest time, we thought the first meeting in Philadelphia was the Oxford Circle Group, which actually started at 13th and Ruskin, and 10th and the Boulevard had a meeting that moved over to 13th and Ruskin. So, now Roy was on his mission trying to be saved by Buddhist and Jesus Christ and meditation and all these different things that he, you know, was trying out so that he didn't have to surrender to this way of life. And a woman named Maureen Mick, who was still alive, and Roy married her before he died so he could leave all his stuff to her and set her up because he had been with her for a number of years. She was the first woman in Narcotics Anonymous on the East Coast. We asked her to come too, but because Roy died, she was going to come with Roy, and because he died, you know, she's all in grievance and everything, so she didn't want to come either. And then a guy named Jim H., he's still alive. We asked if he could come. He was the fifth member of Narcotics Anonymous on the East Coast with the 12 traditions. And he got involved in starting meetings with Roy and Danny and Jim, and they started one of the Friends Hospital, and they went around starting all these different meetings. And then there was these six addicts that went through Eagle Hill Hospital. And that was a guy named Rich M., and Dutch H., and these other guys. And what happened was there was a rehab opening in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, called White Deer Run. And they had knew about Dick, and they asked Dick if he would come up and run it. So Dick left Eagleville Hospital and went up to Williamsport. And he took the message of Narcotics Anonymous there because he knew about it. And there was actually two meetings. One was at Divine Providence Hospital, and the other one was, where was it at? Okay, but they were originally called Drugs Anonymous. I don't know if you know that, right? And this guy was like sort of in charge of them. Well, when they heard about Narcotics Anonymous, they switched the two meetings to Narcotics Anonymous, and they were started in 1972. And the Divine Providence is still going on, because I was just up there taking pictures of it with Denny S. I spoke for Denny S. for 35 years, and he took me down there, and I got pictures of White Deer Run and those two meetings. So Dick came up with this great idea that he didn't Philadelphia was traveling 4 hours to go to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting up there to support it. And he thought somebody was high, and he didn't trust them. So he came up with this idea that he was going to do urines and charge $7 for each friggin' urine. Well, the guys protested and all, and got those two meetings taken off of the Narcotics Anonymous meeting list. Now, you got to remember, at that time in 1973, there was friggin' 9 meetings on the meeting list, and they wiped out 2. Now you're down to 7 meetings, which means you're driving all over Pennsylvania to make meetings. And, you know, it was rough for addicts and all. So that urine thing, then they got Dick to, like, renege on that, and then they went back and they started carrying the message there. And, I mean, you know, people like that to make sacrifices. I mean, there was a guy named Ray who you know, we should have got him to come here, him and his brother. Ray was a functioning addict, we'll call him. He had a job and he had a car. He actually brought his brother Brian to a meeting to help his brother. And while he was bringing his brother, he realized that he was an addict. Well, he became like the Jimmy Kinnon of the Philadelphia area. He was very organized, and he took minutes, and he got what we didn't know anything about, anything except taking stuff from Alcoholics Anonymous, so we started an inner group of Narcotics Anonymous. We were right in the World Service Office requesting literature and paying for it, and the World Service Office wasn't sending us nothing. There was a shortage of paper, so they actually got a guy named Jim the Printer out of AA, and he bootlegged the white books because Roy bought back the white book. So they took all the inside information and they made these bootlegs, and they came in all different color covers because whatever leftover paper was from jobs, they would make it on that paper. So there was like green, yellow, gray, blue, different color covers. And they even got a stamp made, and they had the stamp with the NA logo, and it said Intergroup Approved. And then they did things like 50-50 fundraisers, and they put Narcotics Anonymous on it. I got like some tickets left over. I got number 2 to like 7, and I gave them out to the old guys who were involved back then, who started that stuff. And they called them roundups, because AA called them roundups, and they had this roundup in a junkyard, and they all went to this junkyard, you know, where they took cars apart and shit. and they had a big NA party there. They couldn't find anywhere else. I want to say this, that thank God for the black priest and those people, because when the old timers were running around in the 70s in the Philadelphia area trying to start meetings, they wouldn't let them start any meetings in like the Catholic churches or whatever. It was the Baptist priests, the black guys, who let them open meetings up in their areas. You know, in Olney and Logan and stuff like that. And so these guys, man, did a lot for Narcotics Anonymous to make it what it is today. I really don't know what else to talk about, except that, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous was a big influence in starting Narcotics Anonymous, and I was one of those purists. There was this guy, Jim D., in New Jersey, who did it as a joke. He did this purist newsletter, and there was 20 questions of how to become a purist, and it took off in the Philadelphia area, and I became this purist, and I was like an NA Nazi, and you couldn't say sober in my meeting or talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. I would go to conventions and go bust into the women's meetings and raise my hand because I felt that if you were at a gay and lesbian meeting or a woman's meeting or a men's meeting, you were separating the disease of addiction, because we believe that the disease don't care what toilet you go to, so why should we? And I was this NA Nazi dude, and, you know, my heart was in it to make, and I'm telling you, a lot of Philadelphia people were, was in it to make Narcotics Anonymous stand on its own. Well, by doing that, we chased a lot of the old AA-NA people out of the rooms. They went back to AA. Well, they're starting to come back, and I got, like, my home group has several of them in it now. And, you know, I bite my tongue. I'm not that Nazi guy anymore. And, like, my God and me now have, like, a relationship that if they're here, they're here for a reason. And I think part of the reason is because we don't break their balls about staying sober or anything, and they're attracted to my home group, so they're there for a reason. And I got to be honest with you, man, they've been talking some pretty good stuff that I've been interested in, because, you know, there was a guy at my home group with 40 years clean, and he's got an NA home group, and he was involved in starting the outpatient Eagleville Hospital. The first meeting moved to the outpatient of Eagleville, and he was involved in starting that, and then it moved to Green and Basin Street in Norristown, and then it moved from there to Church on the Mall, and Church on the Mall is going to be like 40 years old next year, and that's the oldest ongoing meeting in the East Coast. We also have up in Pebble Hill in Bucks County, there was this rehab called Today Incorporated, and it was for juveniles. And Dutch started a meeting there. They had an outpatient at County Line and 2nd Street Pike, and the actual rehab was in Newtown. Well, everybody who graduated there would go to the NA meetings at the outpatient, and that guy, George R., well, I don't want to tell his story, but that's where he found Narcotics Anonymous. And he went and started a meeting in Bucks County, and nobody was showing up, so he would go to the outpatient and pick guys up in his car and bring them back. I'll let him tell, because he's going to be speaking here on the basic text. So this purist movement, the funniest thing about this guy Jimmy D., who started it from New Jersey, actually is sober now in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that's freaking hilarious. And he was this purist who started the stuff, and now he goes to AA. As long as he's doing good. Huh?
He's living in North Carolina now.
Oh, he's in North Carolina now? God bless him. I just think that's hilarious. You know, it's a lot of people did a lot of things. Like when the basic text was written, they needed to raise some funds. There was guys that went and gave blood. They gave blood to get money for drugs, and they came up with the idea to go give blood to get money to write the basic text. I mean, people sacrificed their blood to have a basic text. I mean, how cool is that? Yeah, but they did it. You know, George got a pretty cool story. Sold his washer and dryers to go to a World Lit conference. There was a girl that traveled around with him named Teresa W. We tried to get her. She's an AA member now. She runs a halfway house up in Bucks County. She didn't want to come. And like these history conferences, they had one in Connecticut, and they rounded up all the old-timer troops, man. Old-timers came out of the woodwork. Joe Proctor, man, who was like big, and his parents printed the grade book and everything, and he was big in getting it out to all the home groups. He came. He was like a hermit for a lot of years, and he came and seen what Narcotics Anonymous has grown to, and he got to speak there, and we inspired him, and he had love for the fellowship again, and he got reacquainted with people he hadn't seen in 20 years, and this fire got lit under his heart again for Narcotics Anonymous, and I was a part of that, seeing his smile and his eyes light up with love for NA and realizing, you know, what he did for it and everything. And me and Billy were talking about it earlier. This guy was all fired up, man, and he passed away. I'm sure he would be here again. And you know, that's the great things that we do, man. We touch people's lives here and save lives, and that's what it's about. And my love for NA came from that first piece of paper with my name on it saying that I met something that was positive. And, you know, here I am, a little obsessive compulsive about collecting NA archives, and I got an opportunity to come here and be an opening speaker with my man Mike, who I found on the internet through eBay. He sold me a token from Lexington, Kentucky. I don't know if they used it for the toilet.
For patient use only.
Well, it was an old joke that about, you know, it was a nickel to use the pay thing, but you couldn't use it if you had a bent nickel to go to the bathroom. But that's how I met Mike, and by collecting NA archives and making that list with Dutch. I want to tell you this story. I was on a mission to get a first edition basic text. And there was this guy, Mitch, who had one in my area. He went to the Florida convention in 85, to the Frickna. And he bought it there at an auction for $50. Well, I paid $850 and I got it, but it's number 11. But it was all written in from the guys from Florida. Tony D was in it, and Mitch was in it, and Alan, and a couple of other people. And it was all written in, and it wasn't in good condition. Well, I wanted a good one. So I just kept asking around, well, how do I get a first edition? How do I get a first edition? I want a first edition. So they told me there was a guy named Charlie in Florida, and to look him up, and he would help me get one. So I'm going to the Jacksonville, Florida Regional Convention. It moved to Jacksonville that year. And I go there, and I'm asking around for this guy, Charlie. Here, he's the chair of the convention. Little short dude, I go up. I said, hi, Charlie. I'm Danny from Philly. I'm looking to get a first edition basic text. He goes, I know the guy. He goes, call this guy Joe Proctor. He lives in Tennessee, and he'll hook you up. So I called Joe up. I say, hey, Joe, I'm Danny from Philly. I'm collecting NA stuff. I want to get a first edition. He goes, do you have $1,250? I said, yeah, I got $1,250. He goes, okay, I'm going to hook you up. He goes, go to the bank and get me a certified bank check. I go to the bank. He said, call me back when you have it in your hand. I call him back. He goes, all right, write it out to Joseph Proctor. Here's my address. Put it in an envelope. He goes, he told me to take an envelope with a stamp to the bank and everything. I do all that. He gives me all the information. I write it out. He tells me to read him the number, the certified bank check, I put it in the mail. 2 days later, a box comes to my house this big. I'm thinking, a box this big for a basic text? It must be a gag. It's all these boxes into this little box, you know, like. So I'm a little excited, you know. Now, I was a drugstore burglar, and I got addicted to the rush, the adrenaline rush of robbing drugstores. My heart beating out of my chest. I was actually addicted to that. Well, I'm opening this box, and I look down, and I see I'm like, yeah, I got this rush going on again. And I'm opening this box, and I open up the box, and there's a pristine gray book in perfect condition. There's a pristine white floppy book, pristine condition. there's a storybook with the list of whose story's what, pristine condition. A red first edition, number 1652, signed by Chuck Skinner. There's a blue first edition, perfect edition. A second, a third revised, a fourth paper. At this time, I'm like, oh my God, $1,250. I hit the jackpot, and Joe Proctor hooked me up, man. And I called him back, thanked him. I thought I was getting one first edition for $1,250. I just spent $850, but he told me it was in pristine condition, and he sent me the whole collection. And for years, I tried to call him to buy more. Years, and he would never answer the phone. I guess that's when he became the hermit and everything. And man, I would leave messages. This is Danny, the NA collector. Please call me back. I got lots of $1,250 checks. Please. Never heard nothing from him until with that Connecticut history thing a year and a half ago. And I got to hug him and thank him. I think I even nibbled on his ear a little bit for that stuff, man. That was one of my like NA history collector moments, man. It was real cool. So, I mean, I've had experiences like that where it was better than that drugstore burglary. You know what I mean? Where your heart's beating out of your chest. And I got to meet a lot of people, man, and fly around, and I dug through basements and attics and garages and their parents' stuff, and just unbelievable experiences in Narcotics Anonymous, man. And I'm happy to be a member of it. I'm happy to be an archivist. I'm happy to be a historian. I'm happy to display the stuff and copy. If anybody ever, you know, wants any copies of anything, I remember those guys put a history conference together in Lehigh, and we go out there. I drive out there, and we go there, and they had the coolest setup. They had all these copiers, and everybody brought their stuff, and we shared everything. I brought my stuff, Greg bought his, Billy bought his, and we were on these copiers. They had guys set up, like committed members that were friggin' copying it. You'd give them their stuff, and they would copy it. You would say, I want 10 of these, and then you'd give it out to the other 9 members, and you would keep one, and that helped enhance my collection. And, you know, and then they had like an open podium forum where everybody was coming up and all these old timers were speaking and all, and it was just, you know, Bo and you know, that was like 91, right? And that's like when I really started like realizing that I'm a collector, and it was just a really cool experience that people were on the same page as me that cared about our history and had love for it and wanted to, you know, teach people this and show where our roots came from and everything. And just really, really cool stuff, man. I've been to 11 world conventions. Like, I'm addicted to going to them because one of my main collection things is world conventions. I remember I went to the World Service office, and I didn't want to take too much stuff because I flew on a plane, but I brought my world convention collection book. Like, everything's in loose sleeves. Now, you know, I got hundreds of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of hours. Like, everything's all in the right order, and all in these clear binders, and I got them in binder books, and you know, it's crazy. Early in my recovery, I would go through like these depression points. I would call it not serenity, like points in my life. And what I would do is I would get into my NA history collection and start doing stuff with it and get out of that mood that I was in or whatever was going on with me. It would pull me out of my depression. It was like a great thing. So I got into it, and it really helped me, man. And like I said, it gave me an identity of who I was. I finally was somebody, you know, and I was a member of Narcotics Anonymous. It had some important information to me. So, I don't even know what else to talk about. How much time do I got? Mike really screwed me over with giving me like an hour and 20 minutes.
Maybe you should ask your question, Danny.
answer some questions?
Yeah.
I'll do that. That's not a bad idea. All right, I'm gonna close. I want to thank the committee for having me. They got a hold of me, and I tried to help them put some people in place and gave them some information about people, what I knew about them, you know, what they did for Narcotics Anonymous, and I hope I helped. And, you know, they helped me get another day clean, and that's what it's about. Tonight, I know after I close the archives room, I'm going to crash on that pillow like there's no tomorrow. I won't even hear Dan snoring tonight. You know, this is just really an honor and a privilege, and I would do it all again, man. And I got clean when I was 25 years old. I'm 51. I got 25 and a half years clean. And when I came into 25 years old, I thought I was too old, and that, you know, I didn't know what to do with my life, and it was over. And I became an NA history collector. And man, it just begun at 51. I got to tell you, I got a lot more life to live. I got hepatitis C. I did that medicine twice. I'm getting ready to go on that new stuff, the Vertex. I know it's an outside issue, but I got to talk about it because it affects my life. I feel great, but I don't want to die from liver disease like Daniel Carlson, my friend Roy P, because if you don't deal with it, you get cancer in the liver and you die from liver cancer, which is what Danny Carlson and Roy died of. And I know, like, I don't want to do it because I did it twice and it kicked my ass. But in honor of Roy, I'm doing it. Because he did everything he could to save his life. Because he wanted to be here. And he wanted to be alive to speak at the Philadelphia 2013 World Convention, man. And he told me that was his dream. He didn't care if he died the day after. And he couldn't live. So, in honor of him, I'm doing it. That's all I got. Thank you so much. Me and Michael will answer some questions if anybody got anything.
All right, we do have some time, so anybody have any questions?